Good morning and welcome to the Tuesday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day. How to Build a Healthy Meal That Actually Keeps You Full by Cynthia Sass for Health.com. Do you ever eat a healthy lunch only to find yourself starving by 3 p.m.? You're not alone. This is a common frustration I hear from my clients, and in most cases, the explanation is the same. The meal was missing at least one key element that plays a major role in satiety, satisfaction, and energy. Luckily, there's an easy fix. Use my simple formula for crafting meals that stave off hunger, but don't leave you feeling overstuffed or sluggish. I've also included 5 simple examples that fit the bill below. 1. Add fiber-rich veggies. I highly recommend working veggies into every meal, even breakfast. They're nutritious, full of antioxidants, provide very few calories per portion, and are packed with fiber, which is filling because it takes up space in your digestive system. Fiber also slows digestion, which means you'll have a steadier supply of energy over a longer period of time. For breakfast, veggies can be added to an omelet, whipped into a smoothie, or eaten as a side. Many of my clients even enjoy salad at breakfast, dressed with citrus vinaigrette, or a serving of raw veggies that act as a palate cleanser at the end of the meal. All veggies provide some fiber, but a few top sources include artichokes, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, cauliflower, and kale. 2. Choose lean protein. Aside from boosting metabolism, lean protein also wards off hunger better than carbs and fat, according to research. Be sure to include a lean source, think eggs, seafood, poultry, or Greek yogurt, in each meal. If you're a vegan, reach for pulses, the umbrella term for lentils, beans, and peas like chickpeas and black-eyed peas. 3. Don't forget a plant-based fat. There's no doubt about it, fat is satiating. If you've ever eaten a salad with fat-free dressing versus one with olive oil, you've experienced the difference. Plus, the notion that eating fat makes you fat is seriously outdated. I tell my clients to include a healthy source in every meal. My favorites are avocados, nuts, and seeds, including ground-up versions like almond butter and tahini, extra virgin olive oil, Mediterranean olives, olive tapenade, and pestos made with EVOO and nuts or seeds. 4. Toss in a good carb. By now, you probably know that eating a low-fat blueberry muffin for breakfast isn't exactly good for you. But did you realize it will likely leave your stomach grumbling an hour later, despite the whopping 400-calorie count? That's because refined carbs and sugar cause a surge in blood glucose that triggers a quick insulin response. The insulin spike then results in a drop in blood sugar, which means the return of hunger pangs. But that doesn't mean you need to nix carbs altogether. Just opt for a small portion of a fiber-packed whole food source. Good choices include whole grains like oats or quinoa, starchy veggies like skin-on potatoes and squash, fresh fruit, and pulses. Start with a small serving, around half a cup, or the size of half a tennis ball, and up your intake depending on your body's fuel needs. In other words, if you spend most of your hours sitting at a desk, a half cup is probably fine. But if you have an active day ahead, bump up the carbs a bit. 5. Be generous with herbs and spices. Natural herbs and spices are another category of satiety enhancers. I'm talking fresh or dried basil, cilantro, oregano, rosemary, garlic, ginger, cinnamon, turmeric, cumin, zest, and pepper. Even vinegars like balsamic and hot peppers like chili or jalapeno count. Use them to add aroma and flavor and raise your satisfaction level at each meal. Now, you may be wondering what a complete meal that follows all 5 rules would actually look like. If so, here are 5 examples of easy, stick-to-your-ribs, energizing dishes. Veggie scramble. Sauté Brussels sprouts in low-sodium vegetable broth along with more of your favorite veggies like onion and grape tomatoes, along with seasonings such as dried Italian herb mix, turmeric, and black pepper. Add one whole egg and 3 to 4 whites or one whole egg and 3/4 cup whites to scramble. Serve over a half cup of lentils topped with half of a sliced avocado. Turkey Veggie Stir Fry. Brown about 4 ounces of extra lean ground turkey and set aside. Sauté broccoli florets and other veggie faves like bell pepper and mushrooms in low-sodium vegetable broth with minced garlic, fresh grated ginger, and minced chili pepper. Add the turkey back in to reheat. Serve over a small scoop of brown or wild rice and top with sliced almonds. Wild Tuna Salad. Mix canned wild tuna with herbed olive tapenade. Serve over a bed of greens and veggies topped with cooked chilled quinoa. Chilled Egg Salad. Toss a handful of minced kale with a chopped hard-boiled egg and 3 whites. Fold in a tablespoon of dairy-free pesto and mix with a half cup of chickpeas. Black Bean and Veggie Platter. Sauté cauliflower and spinach in low-sodium vegetable broth seasoned with minced garlic and fresh cilantro. Serve with small scoops of black beans and brown rice topped with a dollop of guacamole and wedges of fresh lime. Cynthia Sass is Health's contributing nutrition editor, a New York Times best-selling author, and consultant for the New York Yankees. This article originally appeared on health.com.
Is running good or bad for your knees? By Alexandra Sifferlin. Running has a reputation for causing wear and tear on knees over time, leading to joint pain, arthritis, or other injuries. But a recent small study found that 30 minutes of running actually lowered inflammation in runners' knee joints, leading many to question whether running really does increase a person's risk for injuries or if it helps prevent them. In the report, published in the European Journal of Applied Physiology, researchers at Brigham Young University brought 15 healthy runners, ages 18 to 35, into a lab where they took samples of their blood and knee joint fluid before and after they ran for 30 minutes on a treadmill. They also assessed the same samples when they were sedentary. The researchers expected to find an increase in molecules that spur inflammation in people's knee fluid after they ran, but they didn't. Instead, they found that pro-inflammatory markers actually decreased after a 30-minute run. The scientists ended up only getting complete information from 6 of the people in the study, but they saw the same results in all of those people. It was surprising, says study author Matt Seeley, an associate professor of exercise science at BYU. We expected the molecules to increase, but it was the opposite. Seeley stresses that the report is a pilot study and that due to the small number of people, there's not a lot that can be inferred from the findings. The researchers also only looked at inflammation right after people ran, rather than a week or a month later. But Seeley says his team plans to do the same study in more people in the future. I think and hope the data shows that running is good for your joints, Seeley adds. Although the results are limited, they are also unexpected and could be important. Some experts not involved in the study say that while the study findings are intriguing, even given the small sample size, it's not yet clear whether running can protect knees from injuries or arthritis. There is data on both sides of the fence, says Dr. Brian Feely, an orthopedic surgeon at the University of California, San Francisco. We know that there are some people that run all the time with no knee problems, and others that have arthritis at a relatively young age. Feely was not involved in the recent study. For many runners, a 30-minute session is relatively short, and Feely says the study does not necessarily suggest that long-distance running is safe. Other studies of marathon runners have found changes in cartilage that could suggest potential for injuries that can persist for months after a long race. Taken together, this suggests that there is probably an evolutionary advantage to allow us to run relatively short distances where our bodies protect cartilage from damage by decreasing inflammation, says Feely. Long-distance running may result in a situation where overwhelming the knee's ability to decrease inflammation occurs, leading to the potential for joint degeneration. Both Seeley and Feely agree that the benefits of running outweigh the risks of not running, especially if done in moderation. Other factors like weight or genetics may also contribute to whether a person is more likely to get arthritis or other injuries from running. More research is needed to fully understand the risks and benefits. In the meantime, people who run can reduce their risk of knee problems through cross-training and taking time to recover, as well as paying attention to any pain or swelling. Is running good or bad for your knees? By Alexandra Sifferlin. Running has a reputation for causing wear and tear on knees over time, leading to joint pain, arthritis, or other injuries. But a recent small study found that 30 minutes of running actually lowered inflammation in runners' knee joints, leading many to question whether running really does increase a person's risk for injuries or if it helps prevent them. In the report, published in the European Journal of Applied Physiology, researchers at Brigham Young University brought 15 healthy runners, ages 18 to 35, into a lab where they took samples of their blood and knee joint fluid before and after they ran for 30 minutes on a treadmill. They also assessed the same samples when they were sedentary. The researchers expected to find an increase in molecules that spur inflammation in people's knee fluid after they ran, but they didn't. Instead, they found that pro-inflammatory markers actually decreased after a 30-minute run. The scientists ended up only getting complete information from 6 of the people in the study, but they saw the same results in all of those people. It was surprising, says study author Matt Seeley, an associate professor of exercise science at BYU. We expected the molecules to increase, but it was the opposite. Seeley stresses that the report is a pilot study and that due to the small number of people, there's not a lot that can be inferred from the findings. The researchers also only looked at inflammation right after people ran, rather than a week or a month later. But Seeley says his team plans to do the same study in more people in the future. I think and hope the data shows that running is good for your joints, Seeley adds. Although the results are limited, they are also unexpected and could be important. Some experts not involved in the study say that while the study findings are intriguing, even given the small sample size, it's not yet clear whether running can protect knees from injuries or arthritis. There is data on both sides of the fence, says Dr. Brian Feely, an orthopedic surgeon at the University of California, San Francisco. We know that there are some people that run all the time with no knee problems, and others that have arthritis at a relatively young age. Feely was not involved in the recent study. For many runners, a 30-minute session is relatively short, and Feely says the study does not necessarily suggest that long-distance running is safe. Other studies of marathon runners have found changes in cartilage that could suggest potential for injuries that can persist for months after a long race. Taken together, this suggests that there is probably an evolutionary advantage to allow us to run relatively short distances where our bodies protect cartilage from damage by decreasing inflammation, says Feely. Long-distance running may result in a situation where overwhelming the knee's ability to decrease inflammation occurs, leading to the potential for joint degeneration. Both Seeley and Feely agree that the benefits of running outweigh the risks of not running, especially if done in moderation. Other factors like weight or genetics may also contribute to whether a person is more likely to get arthritis or other injuries from running. More research is needed to fully understand the risks and benefits. In the meantime, people who run can reduce their risk of knee problems through cross-training and taking time to recover, as well as paying attention to any pain or swelling.
Over 100 workers fired after taking part in Day Without Immigrants protest, by Zamira Rahim for Fortune. Over 100 employees have reportedly lost their jobs after joining the Day Without Immigrants protest, which focused on missing a day of work as a response to President Trump's controversial immigration policies. Almost 20 employees at Bradley Coatings Incorporated, a painting company in Tennessee, were fired after not showing up to work, CNBC reports. The news channel obtained a statement from the company's lawyer, Robert Peel. The statement said that all employees had been warned they risked being fired for missing a day of work. The protest itself was not identified as the reason for the terminations. The reason these employees missed work to engage in peaceful demonstrations had nothing to do with BCI's decision to terminate them, said the statement. Two employees at the Grace Community School in Bonita Springs, Florida, have claimed that they were also fired after joining the protest. The head of the school said no employees were terminated. This article originally appeared on Fortune.com.
Donald Trump's demands on NATO defense spending are driving a wedge into Europe, by Simon Schuster, Munich. The European Union may not feel much like a family these days, but its leaders do tend to bicker like one over questions of money and pride, especially when they have a grumpy uncle named Donald Trump calling in debts on defense spending from across the Atlantic. So it was at the Munich Security Conference this weekend, an annual gathering of senior officials from around the world at a plush hotel in the Bavarian capital. It's normally a collegial affair, intended to reaffirm the transatlantic bond against whatever threats the U.S. and Europe see in a given year. But this time was different. Under pressure from the Trump administration to fulfill NATO's spending targets on defense or face the consequences, some European statesmen openly accused their allies of being cheapskates. Others tried to play semantics over what defense spending even means. And as the confrontations in Munich played out on the stage and in the corridors of the Bayerische Hof Hotel, it became clear that the debate over Europe's security will get a lot uglier before it gets resolved. At the head of the U.S. delegation to the conference this year was Vice President Mike Pence, whose speech felt at times like that of a barman, politely insisting to a roomful of drinkers that happy hour is over. He reminded the European leaders in the audience that out of 28 members of the NATO military alliance, only 4 countries other than the U.S. currently meet their obligation to spend at least 2% of their GDP on defense. These are Greece, Estonia, Poland, and the U.K. On its own, the U.S. spends around $650 billion per year, or roughly 3.6% of its GDP. That accounts for more than 70% of the total defense spending of all the NATO allies. Let me be clear on this point, Pence said. The President of the United States expects our allies to keep their word, to fulfill this commitment, and for most, that means the time has come to do more. A burst of applause broke out at this point from the American delegates in the audience, but the Europeans mostly took the remark with blank expressions. And German Chancellor Angela Merkel did not feel the need to clap. Instead, Merkel went on to argue that mutual security went beyond military spending, that, for example, some types of development aid should count as defense spending, in effect equating the construction of hospitals in Africa to the stockpiling of ammo in Europe. When we help people in their home countries to live a better life and thereby prevent crises, this is also a contribution to security, Merkel said from the stage in Munich on Saturday. So I will not be drawn into a debate about who is more military-minded and who is less. In fact, few in the alliance are less military-minded than Germany, largely due to its disastrous history of militarism in the first half of the 20th century. Since then, Germany's defense policy has been shaped by a simple and laudable credo: never again. But the national commitment to pacifism has become hard for Europe's largest economy to defend. Its military has been deliberately stunted, and it is seldom willing or able to take on any combat missions, opting instead to offer rear guard support while Germany's allies carry the brunt of the fighting. So the idea that Germany or any other NATO member could pad its defense budget by spending more on international development did not sit well with Jens Stoltenberg, the Secretary General of the alliance. It's not either development or security, he told Time in an interview on Saturday in Munich. We need both. Asked about Merkel's suggestion that one type of spending could count toward the other, Stoltenberg pointed out that the United Nations already has a spending goal for international development, 0.7% of GDP. But that's not the same thing as NATO's 2% requirement for spending on defense. And splurging on one would not compensate for skimping on the other, Stoltenberg suggested. When we live in more challenging times, we need to invest more in defense. The NATO chief also challenged Merkel's argument that development aid could help bring about peace and security in conflict zones. Actually, he says it's the other way around. We need peace and security to facilitate development. Though the debate may seem pedantic, it points to some fundamental disagreements over the threats that Europe is facing. Along NATO's eastern flank, countries like Poland and the Baltic states are most concerned about the threat from Russia, whose military keeps tank formations and missile batteries primed along its borders with NATO. But those threats feel a lot more remote when seen from Germany, which is more concerned about the risk of refugees flooding into Europe from faraway conflicts in the Middle East and Africa. This difference in perspective led to some heated exchanges in Munich. After German Foreign Minister Sigmar Gabriel offered a version of Merkel's argument for development aid as a form of defense spending, he got a blunt reply from Artis Papriks, the former defense minister of Latvia, a NATO member that borders Russia. "For me, as a Latvian," he said, "it sounds a little bit bitter that support for my borders and the security of my country will be challenged because some other European nations will not pay their share." Gabriel, who also serves as the vice-chancellor in Merkel's government, responded with some choice statistics. Germany would need to spend an extra 25 billion euros, $26.5 billion, on defense over the next few years in order to reach its 2% commitment to NATO. Yet the country is already spending 30 to 40 billion euros per year on the cost of sheltering Syrian, Iraqi, and Afghan refugees, which are flooding into our country because military interventions some years ago went terribly wrong, Gabriel said. It was an unusually pointed rebuke against the U.S., the United Kingdom, France, and other NATO allies whose military interventions have caused havoc in many parts of the Middle East and Northern Africa. "If we take in these refugees, integrate them, and prevent them from going to other parts of the world as foreign fighters, that is also part of the debate that we must have," said Gabriel. It's sound logic, but it likely won't let Germany avoid the need to play a much bigger military role in the years to come. On the sidelines of the conference in Munich, some German politicians admitted as much. "We have to prove to be reliable," Norbert Röttgen, the chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee in the German parliament, told Time. "We must not outsource, after the end of the Cold War, the care and concern for European security." In trying to meet the demands of NATO allies, Röttgen has proposed a compromise. He wants to increase the German defense budget slowly by about 3 billion euros per year, or 0.1% of GDP. But even if he would be able to get the German government and parliament to approve that proposal, it would still take at least another 8 years before the country reaches the 2% benchmark. That isn't likely to satisfy President Trump. During the first meeting of NATO defense ministers since Trump took office, his new defense secretary, James Mattis, issued a warning to the Europeans. The U.S. would be moderating its commitment to Europe's defense, he said, if NATO allies don't increase funding by year's end. "Americans cannot care more for your children's future security than you do," Mattis told his European counterparts in Brussels on Wednesday. If this was a threat, it sounded a lot milder than the ones Trump hurled at NATO in the past. During his campaign for the presidency, he warned that if European allies don't reasonably reimburse the U.S. for the costs of defense, they should expect to be told, "Congratulations, you will be defending yourself." In an interview shortly before his inauguration, he suggested NATO might be obsolete. These remarks caused a lot of alarm on the continent, but they also urged the Europeans to band together in outrage at Trump's disregard for the core NATO principle of mutual defense. Over the past few days, the message they got from Mattis and Pence caused a different reaction. It made the Europeans look closely at one another and at their pocketbooks before starting to quarrel among themselves.
How the web series Brown Girls offers a voice to queer women of color, by Mahida Gajanan. Throughout her 20s, Fatima Ashgar kept waiting to see a movie or television show that reflected her life, her friendships, and relationships. When that didn't happen, she decided to write one herself, a new web series called Brown Girls. Based on the real-life friendship of Ashgar and the series' musical consultant, Jamila Woods, Brown Girls follows two young women making their way through their 20s in Chicago. Layla, a South Asian American coming to terms with her queerness, and her best friend Patricia, a sex-positive black musician struggling with commitment. The series explores storylines the creators feel are rarely covered in mainstream television, namely nuanced relationships between women of color. The first episode opens as Layla, Nabila Hossein, has an intense phone conversation with her aunt, who lectures her about sex and urges her to go to the mosque, all while another woman lies naked in Layla's bed. As a queer South Asian Muslim woman, Asghar, 27, had never seen a character like that before on television. A lot of people come from intersections that get erased on media platforms, she said. If we can shed light that these people exist and are real and have many different personalities, it will expand the definition of what some of these identities mean. Muslim characters have long been underrepresented on the big and small screen, and after the September 11th attacks, they were confined to roles like terrorists and gas station owners, Asghar said. Things have shifted slightly over the past few years with the popularity of shows like Atlanta, Master of None, Insecure, and The Mindy Project, but Asghar still hasn't seen characters that represented her specific experience. Series co-creator and director Sam Bailey said it was important to show diverse characters that are not treated as vessels for pain. When there are stories about people of color, it flirts with trauma porn, Bailey said. There's definitely bad stuff that happens. I just want to add to the narrative that shows they get to be happy. These are people that we know. Along with a diverse cast, the people behind the scenes of Brown Girls are mainly women and people of color, which shaped the collective experience of creating the series. A huge priority was to make our set feel like a good feeling that people could come and specifically contribute things. Even if you're working on creative projects, there are structures that make you feel uncomfortable. We really wanted to create a thing that was counter to that, she says. Brown Girls took on broader importance for Asghar and more political shades of meaning after President Donald Trump took office and issued an executive order banning immigrants from 7 Muslim-majority countries. With Trump, with the election, there's just so much more weight on stuff, Asghar said. It feels like a really important time to have a different representation of Muslims in the world. Seeing more complicated images will really help. Bailey said that while showing complex portrayals of black, queer, and brown women has always been important, it is even more essential now that viewers see accurate depictions of the full spectrum of diversity in America. If I was 15, 16, whatever, and got to see these versions of myself on TV, I would have felt a lot less lonelier, she said. It's more important now because you see different people of color coming together. Brown Girls premieres online Wednesday at 8 p.m. Central Time. People who fear deportation under President Trump are fleeing to Canada for asylum. By Mahita Gajanan. A handful of asylum seekers have fled the U.S. for Canada over the past week amid an immigration crackdown in America under President Donald Trump. Reuters photographer Christine Mushi has captured several scenes of people trekking through snowy woods to cross the U.S.-Canada border on foot and enter Hemingford, Quebec. Among her subjects are people from Yemen and Sudan trying to get into Canada after losing hope of obtaining legal status in the U.S. On Friday, 8 people who said they were from Sudan made it across the border to Canada as U.S. Border Patrol tried to stop them, Reuters reports. 4 adults and 4 young children left a taxi by the border in Champlain, New York, and ran to the Royal Canadian Mounted Police waiting on the other side. U.S. Border Patrol held one man, saying they had to verify his papers. The man then appeared to take his papers from the officer and run across the border, Reuters reports. The officer chased him but stopped once he hit the border. Reuters reports that the officer said the man who crossed the border was in the U.S. illegally and that he would have been detained if caught. Here's what Warren Buffett is betting on now, by Ian Salisbury. Like millions of us, America's most watched investor appears to be embracing the iPhone and iPad while growing weary of that age-old American pastime, the shopping trip. Earlier this week, Warren Buffett's holding company, Berkshire Hathaway, disclosed a big hike in its stake in Apple, while all but closing out its decade-plus-old position in Walmart. Berkshire, which pegged the total value of its holdings at $148 billion on December 31st, also revealed new and additional investments in several U.S. airlines, an industry Buffett has previously disparaged. Along with many other retailers, Walmart, America's largest private sector employer with more than 1.5 million workers, has struggled to cope with the rise of online commerce, especially as arch-rival Amazon.com and others push into the grocery business. Buffett, who first bought Walmart in 2005, has been trimming his stake for years. At the end of last year, however, he slashed the remaining stake by roughly 90%, leaving Berkshire with less than $100 million. By contrast, Berkshire has bet big on Apple recently, roughly tripling his stake to more than $7.7 billion. While Apple is one of the world's most valuable companies, its shares trade at only 16 times its profit, compared to an average of 20.6 for the S&P 500 as a whole. Just 1% of Berkshire's portfolio last fall, Apple has jumped to nearly 5%, making it the holding company's seventh largest single holding. Berkshire's airline investments, now totaling more than $8 billion, include Delta, United, American, and Southwest. Historically, Buffett has been critical of the airline industry, where carriers must pony up enormous initial investment in aircraft and other equipment and have frequently struggled to maintain profitable ticket prices as travelers focus relentlessly on costs. Yet, despite the industry's spotty history, filled with high-profile bankruptcies, the moderate oil prices and innovations like baggage fees have lent stability to the business, even as carriers remain relatively cheap. While Buffett's investing decisions can sometimes seem mysterious, he's not called the Oracle of Omaha for nothing, longtime partner Charlie Munger addressed Berkshire's moves at a business meeting Wednesday. "The nice thing about the game we're in is that we can keep learning," Munger said, according to Reuters. "He's changed when he's buying airlines, and he's changed when he's buying Apple. I don't think we've gone crazy. I think we're adapting." Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.